I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
What's going on in Mali is devastating. There's so much tragedy, and this is trauma on top of 100 plus years of colonial trauma that created the conditions that allowed this type of tragedy to happen. We have theft of water, theft of land, and so much loss of our ecosystem that created this condition that put us in this predicament.
The death toll from the devastating fires on the Hawaiian island of Maui has reached 55 and is expected to rise. The historic town of Lahaina has been destroyed in what's now being described as the largest natural disaster in Hawaii's history. We'll speak to two native Hawaiian activists from Maui about the fires, the legacy of colonialism, and the climate crisis.
The fire is a tragic symbol of this trajectory's terminal point, like where it all ends up if you continue down this mode of extraction as a way to live. But it's also it contains the most deep and durable relics of our history of resistance.
We'll also speak to a fire scientist at the University of Hawaii about how the climate emergency fueled the deadly fires. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Hawaii, the death toll from the historic Maui wildfires has reached at least 55 people and decimated the town of Lahaina, once the epicenter of the Kingdom of Hawaii. One of the more than 1,700 structures that were destroyed is the Na'aikani o Maui Cultural Center. Earlier today, Hawaii Governor Josh Green described the sheer scale of the disaster.
What we saw was likely the largest natural disaster in Hawaii's state history. We are seeing loss of life here. As you know, the number has been rising, and we will continue to see loss of life. We also have seen many hundreds of homes destroyed, and that's going to take a great deal of time to recover from. But that's why we come together. But we talked to an old gentleman who hadn't seen anything like this ever in his life, a wildfire that took a whole city. His neighbors have all lost their homes. His home was intact, but he was in tears. This is a gentleman that doesn't cry easily.
Some residents questioned why Hawaii's emergency warning system didn't go off as blazes rage closer and closer to their homes. President Biden's declared a major disaster as the Hawaiian tragedy has shown a spotlight on the urgency of the unfolding climate catastrophe, as well as the ongoing exploitation and occupation of the islands by the U.S. After headlines, we'll spend the hour on Maui wildfires. Tensions are running high in West Africa after the regional bloc ECOWAS ordered the activation of a standby force for possible intervention in Niger in response to the July 26 military coup. This is Nigerian President Bola Tinubu speaking from yesterday's emergency ECOWAS summit in Nigeria's capital, Abuja.
As you will see from the communique of this extraordinary summit, that no option is taken off the table, including the use of force as a last resort. We remain steadfast in our commitment to supporting Niger in the journey towards peaceful and democratic stability in the country.
The Associated Press reports the Nigerian military coup leaders threatened to kill deposed President Mohamed Bazoum if any military actions attempted to restore his rule. Meanwhile, The Intercept's reporting the U.S. has trained at least five members of the new ruling junta in Niger. The U.S. has since paused security assistance to Niger's military. African officers trained by the U.S. military have now taken part in 11 coups in West Africa since 2008, including in Burkina Faso and Mali. In Ecuador, one suspect is dead and six others have been arrested in connection with the assassination of the Ecuadorian presidential candidate, Fernando Villavicencio. Officials said all suspects in custody are Colombian and alleged members of a drug trafficking group. Ecuador is now under a nationwide state of emergency while authorities continue to search for the possible mastermind behind Villavicencio's assassination. This is the Ecuadorian defense minister, Luis Lara.
The armed forces have begun the immediate deployment of their troops throughout the national territory so that there will be an armed forces presence in every city and every town. They will remain there until the conclusion of the electoral process. Citizens have the guarantee that the armed forces will provide the necessary security for the polls. The vote of Ecuadorians will be the best response to the mafias and their allies.
Villavicencio's murder has thrown Ecuador into further disarray after President Guillermo Lasso dissolved the opposition-led National Assembly in May, blocking efforts by lawmakers to impeach him over accusations of corruption and embezzlement. Meanwhile, Ecuador's snap elections are still scheduled for next Sunday, August 20th, though several presidential and other candidates have suspended their campaigns. In Burma, at least 23 Rohingya refugees are dead after their boat sank as they attempted to reach Malaysia. Over two dozen others are still missing. Thousands of Rohingya Muslims have taken on the perilous trek to Malaysia or Indonesia after fleeing genocide and persecution in Burma. Five U.S. citizens imprisoned in Iran have been transferred to house arrest in what's reportedly a first step towards being released. Their freedom would come in exchange for Iranian prisoners in the U.S. and for Tehran gaining access to $6 billion in their frozen oil revenue to go towards humanitarian needs. The dual citizen prisoners were jailed in Iran on unsubstantiated spying charges. The move comes after 2 years of negotiations, according to the New York Times. This is Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking Thursday.
So this is a positive step, but I don't want to get ahead of its conclusion because there's more work to be done to actually bring them home. My belief is that this is the beginning of the end of their nightmare and the nightmare that their families have experienced.
Blinken said any exchange will not include sanctions relief for Iran. The U.S. Supreme Court has temporarily blocked a sweeping settlement deal for OxyContin maker Purdue Pharma that would shield the Sackler family from civil lawsuits in exchange for paying out $6 billion to thousands of plaintiffs, including state and local governments that have been devastated by the opioid epidemic. The Justice Department challenged the settlement, which extends bankruptcy protections against liability for Sackler family members and what the U.S. Solicitor General called an abuse of the bankruptcy system. Opioid overdoses have killed over 500,000 people in the United States over the past 20 years, according to the CDC, including prescription and illicit drugs. The Louisiana Pardon Board has begun scheduling clemency hearings for the state's death row prisoners one day after Governor John Bel Edwards ordered the move. This comes after the board last month refused to set hearings for 56 death row prisoners who filed a mass petition to commute their sentences before the Democratic Governor Edwards leaves office next year. He opposes the death penalty. In a Fort Pierce, Florida court, Donald Trump and his aide and co-defendant Walt Nauta pleaded not guilty Thursday to three additional charges in the case around Trump's mishandling of classified documents. Trump did not appear at the courthouse in person. The charges came as part of an updated indictment accusing Trump and two aides of trying to delete security footage at his Mar-a-Lago estate. In other Trump news, federal prosecutors proposed a start date of January 2nd, 2024 for the trial related to Trump's bid to overturn the 2020 elections. Mexican officials are demanding Texas remove its border buoys from the Rio Grande, saying the floating barrier aimed at blocking asylum seekers from reaching the United States was installed on Mexico's side of the river. Between the buoys, there are circular saw blades. Dozens of asylum seekers, including children, have been severely injured. Last week, the bodies of two asylum seekers were found in the Rio Grande, one of them trapped in the buoy barrier. Mexico's Foreign Secretary, Alicia Bárcena, spoke Thursday after meeting with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in D.C.
On the buoy issue in Texas, we're deeply concerned about the issue, but thankful because the U.S. Justice Department has filed the lawsuit against the Texas government. And this helps us very much because we're talking about a delicate situation on our border, in our rivers, in the Rio Bravo, in the Rio Grande, but most of the buoys are on the Mexican side.
Democrats have renewed their calls for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas to resign following yet another bombshell report from ProPublica detailing even more lavish gifts from right-wing billionaires, including 38 destination vacations. California Congressmember Ted Lieu said Thomas had, quote, brought shame upon himself and the United States Supreme Court. No government official, elected or unelected, could ethically or legally accept gifts of that scale. He should resign immediately, Lieu said. And Jess Search, the award-winning producer and co-founder of Doc Society, has died at the age of 54 after a battle with brain cancer. The visionary filmmaker was a champion of documentary film, which he believed had the power to change the world, often telling others, quote, if you're going to move people to act, first you have to move them. During her 18 years at Doc Society, formerly known as BritDoc, the organization supported such films as Laura Poitras's Oscar-winning Citizen Four about NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. More recently, Jess Search was an executive producer on the acclaimed While We Watched documentary by director Vinay Shukla about the Indian journalist Ravish Kumar, who took on the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Oscar-winning filmmaker Lucy Walker was one of many who paid tribute to Jess Search, saying, quote, she championed so many underdogs because she loved them. She knew their potential because she'd once been the underdog. Jess Search is survived by her wife, filmmaker Beatie Finzi, and their two children. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the Hawaiian island of Maui, where a devastating hurricane-fueled wire fire has killed at least 55 people. The catastrophic fire destroyed the historic town of Lahaina and left thousands of people homeless in what's being described as the worst natural disaster in Hawaii's history. On Thursday, President Biden issued a major disaster declaration for the state, freeing up federal funds. CNN reports the fire in Maui is now the second deadliest blaze in the United States in a century, trailing only the 2018 Camp Fire in California, which killed 85 people. And the death toll in Maui is expected to rise as search crews reach areas destroyed by the fast-moving fires. Hospitals are overwhelmed with burn patients. Power and cell service remains out for much of the area. Authorities say the fire destroyed all the buildings in the historic section of Lahaina, which once served as the capital of the Hawaiian Kingdom. Hawaii's Governor Josh Green says it looks like a bomb went off in the town. Later in the show, we'll speak to two Native Hawaiian activists in Maui, but we begin with a horrifying account from a man from Fresno, California, named Wise Fonsilinkum, who survived the fire by racing into the ocean with his wife and five children. The family was visiting Lahaina for dinner when they got trapped by the fire.
And we tried to make our way back, but we couldn't. We got stuck. We tried to come back. We ended up in Front Street, my family and I, and it was just black smoke coming above us, and traffic was stuck. We were there by the seawall, by bubble gum, I believe, and it got really real when we saw the flames. And I had to think fast. We had to get out. We left our vehicle. And myself, my wife, and our five kids, we all got in the ocean. We found a floating board that we hung on to. And everything, we're out there floating. And this is so surreal. And everything was burning around, explosions, cars blowing up. Like, embers were flying. We couldn't breathe. There's no air. It's just the carbon monoxide. And we held on as best as we could. My wife, my kids, my older ones helped with the younger ones, and we tried to stick out together. The waves was trying to take us out to the ocean. We had to come back. There were some locals that helped us too that were with us. They're really great people. These people are amazing. And we were out for 3 hours, and we hung on to the seawall as best as we could until we found a little cove area where we were about for an hour with two of the locals were with us and my family. I found some sheet metal to cover them because there was just still fire all around us. And embers were flying out. We cover them and cover myself as best as I could. At about 9:30 p.m., fire came to rescue us. And we walked through the town, the little corridor they made, and everything was just burned. Everything was destroyed. And yeah, we were at the shelter for that night. The fight or flight, instinct, survival. My adrenaline was rushing. It had to calm down. I worked in the ER for 15 years. You gotta help. You gotta take a deep breath. You gotta do this. We did. My kids were amazing. They were really good. A few points, my daughter, my little girl, is like, Daddy, you okay, Daddy? My other one told me, we'll be okay. They got us, and they're really stopped, tired, exhausted. And at some point, this ocean almost swept my kids away a few times. We stuck together. We held on. We're not going to die this way. No. And then we're here. We're alive.
That was Wise Fonsalingam, who survived the fire in Maui by racing into the ocean with his wife and five children. When we come back, we'll speak to two native Hawaiian activists in Maui about the catastrophic fires. Stay with us. No ane I Coca-Cola, no ane I Coca-Cola, ea, e na kupuna. A ohe mea nanai ho'oni, a ohe mea nanai kula'i, ea, e na makua. No'ane'i, We Belong Here by the Hawaiian singer Kalanipea. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue to look at the catastrophic wildfires in Maui. We turn to Kaniela Singh, who is the national director of the Green New Deal Network. Ng is a seventh-generation native Hawaiian from Maui. I spoke to him on Thursday night, asking him to talk about what's happened to Maui and the historical significance of Lahaina Town.
Sure. First off, thank you for having me and centering this issue. I will preface by saying that I've been really busy, but when I'm not doing these interviews, I just tend to like break down. These are really somber times. I was born and raised in Maui. I'm Kanaka Maoli, Native Hawaiian, come from seven generations, and our island is on fire. Our most historic town was set ablaze by wildfires. Hundreds of people have been evacuated and hospitalized. The death toll is climbing and people are searching for loved ones right now. So Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis, Tim Scott, Joe Manchin, oil companies, and anyone in power who denies climate change, to me, are the arsonists here, and we're living the climate emergency. So it is sad times right now. It's heartening to see the community come together and deliver goods to the families in need. Fundraising has been incredible for the direct relief. But what I'm wondering personally is, once the recovery efforts start to unfold and the cameras are gone, who's going to be left, more powerful or less powerful? Are people still going to be paying attention when the recovery work is going to last for years? And is that going to make community members stronger, or is it going to make the people who have mismanaged the land and water and created the conditions for these fires to happen even more powerful? And that's what we're focused on at Green New Deal Network right now.
Kaniela, can you talk about specifically the friends, the family, what has happened to those that have been devastated by the fires, particularly in Lahaina? Can you tell us some of those escape stories, some of what has taken place with the fires so suddenly wiping out this historic city, and then talk about the historic nature of Lahaina as the capital of the Hawaiian kingdom and what that means.
We're a tropical island here on Maui. We're not supposed to have wildfires. This came as a shock to everyone. There's not enough firefighters here. We can't ship them over from the next state. We're an island. So everyone right now is feeling a bit overwhelmed. As it occurred, we saw community members jumping into the ocean, which with nowhere else to go, just floating and watching their homes being reduced into ashes. The death toll went from 6 to 36 all of a sudden, and there are still firefighters, Red Cross members out there searching for our loved ones. It was apocalyptic. The scene was something that, you would only see in a movie. But the reality is, like, this is becoming quite the norm now, and it will become more so in the future. Lahaina Town is actually, it's often characterized as a tourist town, but the people who live there, which should be the focus, tend to be some of the most rooted Native Hawaiians that I've ever met. They're the types of, their families from generations ago created aquaculture, which like the West is only kind of learning about now. I used to work with them to figure out better ways that NOAA could manage like fisheries. They're really the keepers of the ancestral knowledge. And, most of the folks that are evacuated are Kanaka Maoli or other like immigrant folks. And my heart goes out to those families.
When you say it's a tourist town, that's because it's historic. So talk about what that means. Give us a history lesson about Hawaii and about Maui and how it relates to the mainland United States, even how it became a part of the United States.
Sure. So Lahaina Town was a thriving center of Hawaii. It was like the heart of Hawaii before not just statehood, but before Hawaii was even a territory of the United States. So if you start from one end of Front Street and walk to the other, it's like a Disneyland ride of through the colonial timeline of capitalism in Hawaii, starting from royalty, going to whaling, sandalwood, sugar and pineapple, tourism to luxury. And to me, the fire is a tragic symbol of this trajectory's terminal point, like where it all ends up if you continue down this mode of extraction as a way to live. But it's also like it contains the most deep and durable relics of our history of resistance, the museums, the architecture, the infrastructure, the banyan tree, the oldest and largest in the United States, which just burnt 150 years old this year. Like it includes all that, but also just the fact of how slow it was to develop is a testament to the people-powered, usually native-led resistance that each industry faced along the way.
You refer to the raging wildfires as a result of colonial greed. Explain.
Yeah, so there's two facets to this. First is climate change. The National Weather Service says the cause of this fire was a downed power line and the spread because of hurricane force winds, and the spread was caused by dry vegetation and low humidity. Those are all functions of climate change. This isn't disputable. This isn't political. It's unfortunately, it has become politicized, but it's a matter of fact. Climate pollution, corporate polluters that set a blanket of pollution in the air that is overheating our planet, caused the conditions that led to this fire. In addition, there's mismanagement of land. The original Big Five oligarchy in Hawaii, missionary families that took over our economy and government, they continue on today as some of our largest political donors and landowners and corporations. They've been grabbing land and diverting water away from this area for a very long time now, for generations. And Lahaina was actually a wetland. You could take a, like Viola Church, you could have boats circulating the church back in the day. But, you know, because they needed water for their corporate ventures like golf courses and hotels and monocropping, that has ended. So the natural form of Lahaina would have never caught on fire. These disasters are anything but natural. So yes, colonial greed in the fact that they caused the pollution that warmed our planet and set hurricanes like this to become the norm, and the gross mismanagement of our land and water, which the Green New Deal actually is about returning both, you know, both mitigating climate change, building resilience, but also returning the stewardship of land and water to the people.
Can you talk about the dry land right now? I mean, you have Hurricane Dora hundreds of miles away. The wind was intense, but the drought that existed, that relationship to climate change.
Yeah, that's right. So we, growing up on this island, we saw maybe one or two fires, and they're very contained when things got to this drought factor. It's never been anything close to this. This shocked even like the climate scientists that I've worked with over the years were shocked by this fire. And a lot of it has to do with these dry conditions. Growing up, my dad would drive us to church and he'd point out to the sugarcane and he'd say, when you're my age, all the sugarcane would be gone. And I was like, you know, okay, sure. It's such a central part of Maui, but he was right. The sugar is gone. And the reason why is because one of these big five oligarchical corporations that I spoke of knew that the sugar wasn't profitable, but they continued monocropping most of the island in order to get some tax breaks for agriculture. Now, I grew up in a community where it would rain cane ash on us, and it was like fun. I didn't realize we're all getting asthma. We're an environmental justice community. But you know, there were people that fought against the cane burning. And the corporation ended up blaming the activists for the sugar shutting down, pitting the union workers against the community. The result now is just like a fallow, really dry land across the whole Central Valley of our island. And really, if community members and union members were to unite and have been organized years ago, we could have had a much different future. That's still something that I think we should continue working to build, is that labor and environmental unity.
Can you talk about the April survey of homeless people, unhoused people? I think it was something like 704 unhoused people in Maui County, among them 244 suffering from mental health disabilities. The unhoused crisis among Native Americans, Native Hawaiians, and what do you know about Native Hawaiians who were unhoused and how the wildfires have affected them?
Yeah, I think there's a certain perception of Native Hawaiians who are unsheltered. That does not fit with reality. Some of the unsheltered Hawaiian communities that continue today were occupations of land that was getting seized. And they're like, look, if we don't want to cooperate with this new extractive economy that y'all created, so we're going to live on by ourselves in our own community on this beach. We're going to govern ourselves, and they're quite organized and they're living in a way that's subsistent and in harmony with nature. Now, it's not to be glamorized. A lot of these folks face some really dire conditions, not being a part of this capitalist system, but a lot of them are doing it based on really strong and sensible beliefs. Now, when a climate crisis hits, when a disaster hits, it's going to impact these people first and worst, no doubt. And we need to make sure that both relief and recovery efforts in the longer term are prioritizing the low income and indigenous people that that are some are still unaccounted for. Some don't even have IDs. And they need to be front of mind with it, with everything we do, from, you know, day zero when the disaster breaks to years out when we're recovering.
The wildfires occurred on the same day that President Biden said in an interview that he had practically declared a climate emergency, but he has not actually formally done that. What would that mean?
Yeah. I've just been frantically